Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Catherine Parnell, and along with my co-counsel, Captain Allison Rowley, I represent the United States. This court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case for two reasons. First, because the court-martial had jurisdiction over appellant, and second, because the military judge did not abuse his discretion either in denying the production of defense witnesses and experts, nor in his denial of defense challenges for cause. Turning to the first assignment of error, even assuming that there was a break in appellant service, the court-martial had Article III jurisdiction over appellant.
Does the government concede there was a break in service?
Your Honor, to the extent that the Army Court of Criminal Appeals found that as a matter of fact that there was a break in service, the government does not contest it at this stage. However, that does depend on what effect we give to the court-martial convening authorities designation that all of appellant's time in confinement should be treated as good for all intents and purposes. So, but regardless of whether there was or was not a break in service, Article III would still serve to revive jurisdiction.
Okay, go ahead.
Because all four of the criteria of Article III Alpha are met. First, the referred offense is punishable by more than 5 years of confinement. Secondly, the case cannot be tried in the courts of the United States or a state, territory, or the District of Columbia. Third, the appellant was subject to the code at the time of his courts-martial. And fourth, the statute of limitations did not apply. To appellant's argument regarding the double jeopardy question, respectfully, that is answered by Gamble. The separate sovereigns doctrine allows the government to proceed, federal government to proceed, regardless of the state proceeding. But turning to this court's analysis in the portion of Willenbring versus Neurader that was not overruled by Mingahas, the discussion of Article III talks about the statute of limitations bar, which operates at the trial level, very similar to a double jeopardy bar. That is, the appellant raises it as a motion to dismiss, as a procedural bar, something like an affirmative defense. There is no reason to treat the double jeopardy bar any differently than a statute of limitations bar for purposes of analyzing Article III. Therefore, under Article III Alpha, even if there was a break in service, it was revived.
Well, it's not just a double jeopardy. It's a piece of statutory construction, isn't it, counsel? You've got Article III, which is a statute, and you've got to parse this thing. And the appellant insists with some force that the way the government is parsing it is silly. So can you give me your parse of it?
Your Honor, the government believes that the statute's plain reading should be honored, and it says cannot be tried, which refers to the present tense. If there is not a jurisdiction that can try the offense at the time that the...
It's time-dependent, isn't it? At the time of what?
At the time of the court-martial, Your Honor. So at the time that the government seeks to exercise jurisdiction over the crimes and offenses, if it cannot be tried in a state, a territory, or the District of Columbia...
Even if the reason is that it's already been tried in the state.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, turning to the portion of Willenbring that was not abrogated by Mingahas, this court did discuss the meaning of cannot be tried in the present tense in the reading of that statute. And the government agrees with that reading of Article III Alpha.
Okay. Then if we disagree with your construction of Article III, does he walk?
Your Honor, that would certainly complicate the application of Article III Alpha if this court disagreed with our interpretation. And then the question of whether there was a break in service would become more legally relevant. The government's primary argument is that we don't need to determine...
Right. I understand the government's argument, which is that whether or not there was a break, it's saved by 3A.
Correct.
And what you're saying is if 3A departs the scene, then suddenly... The question of whether there's a break becomes a whole lot more important in the government's construction.
So, just if you wouldn't mind indulging me, the break in service and the situation that appellant in this case faces in terms of he's charged with having committed, well, in a status in which he was subject to this chapter, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
An offense against this chapter, punishable
by
more than 5 years. How is that any different? Than Toth, right, at the point in time, right, because Toth, right, was charged with murder and conspiracy to commit murder, that he had allegedly committed while he was on active duty, and then he separated from the service. There was a complete break in service. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that, right? And so up until the point of a reenlistment and a subsequent retirement, it seems to me that they are exactly the same situation. So explain to me how it's different and why it isn't, in fact, the same situation.
I would agree with you, Your Honor, that the crimes are similar. However, what we have in this case, if we look at this court's precedent in Clardy and then also more recently in Christensen, we have an appellant who was being paid the entire time that he was in civilian confinement pending his trial in the state court, so he was in a pay status. We never lost jurisdiction over him. He never out-processed up until his reenlistment for purposes, his discharge for purposes of reenlistment. He never obtained a DD-214. He was not out-processed. We never separated him. So to the extent that there's a question about this period, whether you consider it to be 3 years while he was in civilian confinement or 3 weeks if you follow the Army Court's opinion, we never lost jurisdiction. We never separated him effectively.
Right, once the convening authority takes the action that the convening authority does take, and they say, based on my construction of the time and based on how I'm going to treat this time, his ETS was in 1986, right? And so then based on Clardy, right, he was, for that period of time, since the ETS had already run prior to the reenlistment, he was a civilian.
Yes, Your Honor, and that relates to Judge Sparks' question to my colleague, and I think that turning to this court's precedent most recently in Christensen and talking about how the Army loses jurisdiction over a person, appellant was in a position where he never out-processed. We never lost the jurisdiction, even though he was in civilian confinement. And again, I think it turns on whether this court finds the convening authority's memorandum restoring his time to be effective. That's a matter of fact, may not be presented in this case, but whether the convening authority could actually effectively restore that. The Army Court treated it as fact, and therefore the government does not contest that particular three-week break that the Army found as a matter of fact. As a matter of law, the Army also found that the Article III revived jurisdiction. So our argument in the event that the
this they court address the specific question that I have, which is how do you distinguish if he's a civilian, even if it's for one day, right, and there's a break in service, how do you distinguish that from Toth?
Your Honor, I think the only way to, or the way to distinguish it would be if it's a civilian for even one day, the question of whether we actually ever severed jurisdiction, whether we ever lost it in that period of reenlistment. Also, Clardy talks about the immediate reenlistment. If the discharge is only for purposes of reenlistment to enter another military status, then perhaps we don't lose it. And so that would be the distinction.
But that was when the ETS hadn't run.
Yes, Your Honor, and that is a distinguishing factor in this case. So the crimes are similar to Toth, but the government would submit that the Army never lost jurisdiction by virtue of the fact that appellant never actually separated.
I'm not telling you how to frame your argument, but is the government implying that it might be hanging its hat ultimately on matters like a final accounting of pay and the issuance of a 214 and all that other stuff that's in the statute?
No, Your Honor. The government's primary argument is that even if there was a break in service, Article 3 Alpha is...
No. If 3 falls out of the picture.
If 3 Alpha falls out of the picture, then that is part of the argument.
Yeah, because you're saying that... I think, as a matter of fact, and of course, we can't find as a matter of fact anything, but as a matter of fact, he wasn't discharged regardless of whether he had a break in service, I think is what you're saying.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That to the extent that there was a moment where the Army could have lost jurisdiction,
right,
as the court has found in other cases, if appellant was in this limbo status, we never fully discharged him. Admittedly, those cases don't discuss the passage of an ETS, but it is still relevant.
Well, and you also had a UOTHC hanging out there for a while that never got imposed.
Correct, Your Honor, and that was withdrawn when appellant.
Right. That's not operative.
So, in terms of getting back to the plain language of 3A, forget the word cannot, but it all focuses on just three letters: can. Why should we hang our hat on that when it results in such an absurd result, where there isn't any other sentence structure, any other cues within the statute except for can. And it's a situation where it is because he is acquitted that results in the imposition of the death penalty in the military.
Your Honor, I think that when we look at the legislative history surrounding Article 3 Alpha and the problem that Congress wished to solve, that is the Hirschberg problem, trying to close the loophole for serious offenses that occur during a prior period of service, that to construe the prosecution of appellant and others similarly situated as an absurd result misreads the intent of Congress in creating that broad statutory extension under Article 3 Alpha. And so the best reading is that cannot be tried. The double jeopardy bar, as I mentioned, procedurally is very similar to the statute of limitations bar that this court found to be to trigger Article 3 Alpha in Willenbring. And so when you're looking at an appellant who is could theoretically be indicted in a different court, but certainly that case shouldn't proceed, or as Judge Ryan noted, the prosecutor, by virtue of ethics, should not bring it because of that procedural bar, then we are in a situation where, presently speaking, at the time of court-martial, it cannot be tried. And that
but you seem to be conflating two different things, the factual argument with the issue I'm asking about in terms of the absurdity of taking those three words can in the or letters can and the word cannot and hanging our hat strictly on that as compared to Congress saying could not have been or something similar. Why should we be so confident that the plain language reading here is really what Congress intended?
Your Honor, I think looking at the legislative history certainly gives us that impression, but furthermore, we expect that if Congress wanted it to say could not be tried, then they certainly could have legislated that way. They said cannot be tried in that present moment, as again, they were trying to close the loop that was created, or the loophole that was created by Hirschberg. And so given this legislative history talking about the revival of jurisdiction, and given the fact that we do read the language that is on the text of the statute, Congress could have said could have not, they did not. They said cannot be tried, and that is the appropriate plain reading. Turning to the
Counsel, may I ask just one question about Willenbring? I believe in appellant's reply brief, they say that Willenbring really shouldn't have so much force on this cannot be tried because of the statute of limitations issue, because upon further proceedings, it was determined in Willenbring that actually there was no break in service, and such that everything that we said in Willenbring was sort of hypothetical, and that doesn't count.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with another opinion of this court that indicates that what it said in Willenbring, barring the Mangahas issue, is not good law, and I think it's certainly instructive because of the amount of attention that both Willenbring and Clay gave to the legislative history and the intent of Congress. I think it's instructive, even if it's not necessarily dispositive as to this issue. Turning to the service connectedness of this offense, the court-martial had jurisdiction over appellant based on his status as a retiree. However, even if this court were to apply the service connection test, the crimes were sufficiently service connected to confer jurisdiction. In this case, we have an appellant who was on active duty, who murdered three military dependents of an active duty Air Force captain, who was TDY on military orders within a mile of Fort Bragg. Even if this court were to revive the O'Callaghan and Relford factors, this case would satisfy those factors.
But what about the fact that the government back in the 80s said, here, North Carolina, you handle it. It didn't seem as if the military at that point was saying, gee, this is a case that we really care about. This is a case that is service connected. So how do we square that?
Your Honor, I think that this court could consider that, although perhaps the discretionary decision of one command versus another to take action in a particular case should not weigh as heavily. But as Solario tells us, the status of the appellant is the sole test for jurisdiction over these offenses. But even if this court were to look at the O'Callaghan and Relford factors, I think Gray is instructive. And Gray had very similar facts. The murder in that case was on post, but it was an active duty service member and committed by a service member. And this court found that even if there was a question of whether Solario extended to capital cases, they need not reach it in Gray simply because the service connectedness of the offense was sufficient. So to Your Honor's question, I think that in light of Gray, even despite the fact that the military initially chose not to prosecute this offense, there's nothing in the record to suggest what that calculus was. But even if they did not prosecute it at the time, that did not diminish the service connectedness of the offense, especially once the DNA came back and showed that Mastrin Hennis was the donor, or pardon me, was linked to the sperm found inside of Katie Eastburn. And so to the extent that there's an additional service connection, once we have the knowledge that this DNA is present, I think that that still satisfies O'Callaghan and Relford.
Counsel, you said that, that we had jurisdiction over him because as a retiree, the appellant's counsel raised the question of basically the government double-dipping under both A1 and A4. What is your position as to which of those provisions the Army claimed jurisdiction by?
Yes, Your Honor. The government's position is that it was as a retiree, so under Alpha 4, and I would point this court to Pearson versus Bloss and to Hooper. And the joint appendix appellant conceded, in fact, that if he were recalled as a retiree pursuant to Pearson, that the jurisdiction would be effective over him. And Pearson and Hooper stand for the proposition. Pearson says that you can be recalled to be prosecuted as an enlisted person who is a retiree, and Hooper stands for the proposition that you don't have to be recalled in order to be court-martialed so long as you're in a valid status. So the government's position is, regardless of how the Army chose to effectuate or facilitate its actual court-martial, the logistics of the court-martial and command and control over appellant, that does not change the personal jurisdiction of him as someone who is subject to the code. And so because he was always subject to Article 2 UCMJ, the fact that he was recalled to active duty to facilitate, as the appellant argued in Hooper, makes no difference with respect to personal jurisdiction over him or the offense. Pardon me, personal jurisdiction over him, subject matter jurisdiction over the offense. Turning to the question of appellant's complete defense, the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he denied appellant's request for additional funding and witnesses. I will take the question of expert witnesses first. Military judge, his actions here are reviewed for abuse of discretion, and that means that we look at what the military judge was presented at the time the motion was made, the Article 39As, the declarations of appellant's experts. And under those circumstances, the military judge's decision to deny additional funding for the defense expert was neither arbitrary nor capricious nor unreasonable, particularly because the defense could not make an affirmative link between the testing that they wished to do and the possibility that would actually supply them additional evidence for the third-party culpability theory they wished to present. Specifically,
but weren't they in a catch-22 position here? Didn't the military judge's ruling render hollow RCM 701 in terms of how much needs to be shown up front and so forth and so on before you get the testing done?
No, Your Honor, particularly not in the context of a third motion for additional funding and for retesting. So the procedural posture of this case is such that at the initiation of the court-martial, appellant was provided a number of experts, a number of expert witnesses, the opportunity to test specific items of evidence to include the fingernails, to include the sample from Katie Eastburn's vaginal vault, to include certain items from the crime scene. And then when the defense came back, Joint Appendix 217 to 218 or 219, there's a discussion of testing everything. Mr. Renner wanted to test all 154 items that were seized from the crime scene, to include the contents of the vacuum, the pipe fittings from the house, portions of the carpet. And the military judge found in his discussion with defense counsel that he could not establish a link between the testing that the defense wanted to do to identify a third party and either a scientific method for actually creating that third party profile or a way to time and date the DNA sample that might have been left in the house.
But so doesn't this show a disparity between the authority, the power of the federal government as compared to a defendant, where the government gets to decide everything it wants to test? Then the government says, but we're not going to let you, defense, test what you'd like, and the military judge signs off onto that. Isn't there a problem there?
No, Your Honor, not so long as the military judge is applying the standards that this court articulated in Lloyd and Gonzalez. In the place where the defense failed in this instance, was describing what the expert would do for the defense. And turning to Wooleader, that case stands for the proposition that the defense has to meet the requirements for its funding on its own. And it failed to do that in this case, in part because to the extent that appellant had already been excluded from all of the items that had been tested, and also the items that weren't tested, the defense conceded at Joint Appendix 230 that he would be able to argue this third-party culpability theory, that he could impeach the government's case by virtue of the fact that it certainly didn't link to Hennis. To the extent it was unidentified, it probably belonged to somebody else, so a third party might have been in the house. And also the government could not argue anything that had not been tested and linked to appellant. So in the context of this third motion for additional funding and this third motion for testing, the military judge is also in a situation where on Joint Appendix 230, he has the discussion with the defense about their failure to use testing money that had already been allotted to them for the testing of the Mr. X letters, etc. So again, this is contextual. The military judge is sitting at a moment in trial where he's on a third motion to compel additional funding and additional testing, and he asked the defense to make that link. At record 1101, the defense declined to expand on its theory, and the military judge said, if you give me something, if you tell me, for instance, that your expert disagrees with the government's existing testing, or that you think that you found something that could justify the expenditure, it would help your case, and the defense declines to do so. And while that puts the defense in a difficult position, they're still required to meet their burden. So where a military judge is faced with this evidence and this proffer from the defense in that Article 39A, it's not an abuse of discretion for him to say, I do not believe that at this juncture you've met your burden on this issue. Turning to the question of the witnesses denied by the military judge. The military judge denied three witnesses that the defense believes should have been produced at trial: Ms. Krings, Mr. Staley, and Mr. Pilt. And as this court noted earlier, at the motions hearing to discuss the presentation of the defense failed to make a link between Mr. Hill as a possible suspect and this case. All they could talk about was his proximity, that is, he was in the area at the time, that he displayed scratches on his face. The military judge pointedly asked the defense counsel whether anyone with scratches on their face at the time of the murders was a suspect. The defense had no answer. They could not supply either that he had access to Mr. Staley's van, nor that he was actually in a position to have used it. And while the military judge does cite to the DNA exclusion of Mr. Hill, the relevance of that is that it severs the connection between Mr. Hill as a suspect and the way that the defense wishes to use Mr. Hill at trial. Again, it's an abuse of discretion standard. And so if this decision was not arbitrary or capricious, if he didn't apply the wrong law, if he didn't make clearly erroneous findings of fact in this instance, his decision should be granted great deference.
Counsel, I'd like to point out to you a quote from page 57 of your brief, where you say the defense can test evidence that is the linchpin of the government's case. Doesn't that read McAllister much too narrowly? It's not just linchpin evidence.
Your Honor, I think that when discussing McAllister, we're looking at a situation where in McAllister, the defense was denied the opportunity to use a new testing method on different evidence. So there was a question of the advancement in DNA technology and the government denying funding for the testing of the evidence that linked the appellant to the crime in that case using a new, potentially better test. That's not the situation that we're in this case. Specifically with respect to the DNA that appellant wished to test from the scene, what he wished to do was create a third-party profile, and the military judge repeatedly asked defense counsel to describe how that might be done, and the defense counsel could not come up with could not describe to the military judge a way that this testing would reveal a third-party culpability theory by creating this unknown profile. And so the military judge decided at that point that there was not materiality or necessity.
How does it fit into the concept of the DNA database? Not just a situation where the defense had to say, we think Mr. X, let's say for the sake of argument, Mr. Hill is the one, and we're looking for evidence, DNA evidence that would support it. With the benefits of the DNA database, what happened if you found just one instance of DNA evidence where when it's run through the database, you find that it is a serial killer who is sitting in North Carolina's death row? Doesn't that entirely change the equation for Mr. Hennis?
I think it would have if that had been presented, Your Honor. And what was presented in this case was a question of the biological trace evidence. There was no suggestion that there was a complete DNA profile that could have been created from any of the evidence that was collected at the scene. Furthermore, the profile that the government created in order to look at the biological trace evidence was available to the defense. So to the extent that they wished to make that particular argument, their experts were in a position through their declarations to do so, to say, we believe that we found enough to create a third-party profile that we could run against a database. But that's not what the experts said in their declarations. They said that they might be able to identify a perpetrator depending on the quality of the evidence. And particularly with...
So I'm getting back, though, to the problem I have with the chicken and egg, where there seems to be the burden on the defense to show a connection before they're given the opportunity to show the connection.
Respectfully, Your Honor, in this case, when we already have substantial testing that was performed by the defense and performed at the defense's request, I don't think that we're in that situation. This is not McAllister. It's more like Lloyd, where the defendant was denied the opportunity to test multiple blood splatters to prove that there might have been another perpetrator because he couldn't show demonstrated necessity and certainly couldn't indicate that there was a link between a specific defense theory and the blood splatter that he wanted to test. And so I think that this situation is far more like Lloyd, where we have a breakdown in the link between the experts were probably in the best position to provide this for the defense, or when pressed at record 1101, the defense counsel could have articulated a better link, and it simply doesn't appear in the record. So under those...
So you don't think that argument was inherent in what was actually stated by the experts in the defense at that time, talking about... Because there seems to have been a misunderstanding on the part of the military judge where he didn't consider the DNA database. And this trial wasn't all that long ago. Certainly, DNA database was well known within criminal justice circles. So you don't think it was inherent in the argument that was made?
No, Your Honor, because when we look at the declaration by Mr. Blake and by Mr. Renner, the chances of actually creating that third-party profile sufficient to test against a DNA database appeared to be speculative at best.
I'm trying to just understand that factual point.
Yes,
so you're saying the quality of the DNA evidence that was recovered on the crime scene, that evidence was not of the quality that could have been tested against the DNA database?
Your Honor, the best of my understanding of the record is that the unidentified biological trace evidence that was present at the scene may not have been sufficient to successfully create a third-party profile to test against such a database. Now, had the defense expert in this case said, I believe I can create an unknown profile from the evidence that is there. I've looked at the government's results. I've indicated that I think that there's a flaw in the testing. I think that perhaps the tie to my client is a false positive. I think any of those things might have gotten that link for the defense. But when we look at the declarations supplied by Dr. Blake and Mr. Renner, I simply don't believe that that connection is there, and therefore the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he denied those expert witnesses. Turning to the question of voir dire, the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he limited the defense voir dire or denied the defense challenges for cause in this case. Appellant has raised two issues with the voir dire. First, the restriction of appellant's ability to conduct voir dire, and the second, the challenges for cause. I'd like to address the restriction of the voir dire first. This court has held that the military judge has the broad discretion to see to the management of the courtroom and to voir dire, and therefore the military judge was well within his discretion when he elected to limit the defense voir dire after an unsuccessful series of death penalty hypotheticals that were attempting to address members' deeply held opinions about the death penalty. However, the military judge found those hypotheticals to be misleading, unfair, and that when held in a vacuum, they treated the members unfairly. He was well within his discretion to do so. The defense in this case was able to exercise their challenges freely and intelligently, and the military judge properly restricted the defense when he felt that they were in a situation similar to Nieto, where the members appeared to be in a mousetrap, where the hypothetical was so egregious, mentioned only the aggravating factors that were part of the referral, such that the panel member had a visceral initial reaction that may have led them to say things that painted them unfairly. There are three members that appellant challenges for bias: Colonel Boyd, Colonel Watson, and Major Wiedler. The military judge did not abuse his discretion when denying the defense challenges for cause for any of those three members. First, appellant challenges Colonel Boyd for his predisposition to impose a death sentence. However, Colonel Boyd said that he was willing to be persuaded. He was not unalterably. And when the military judge addressed that challenge for cause, he not only cited to the correct standard for implied bias, but also discussed the liberal grant mandate. This is not a Clay situation where he merely says those things and then denies a challenge for cause. He analyzes the specific basis for challenge and then declines to grant it. Turning to Major Wiedlich, the defense challenged Major Wiedlich for his inability to consider mitigation evidence. However, Major Wiedlich is a panel member who during his voir dire said he could not conceive of a situation where he would vote for the death penalty, that he would consider mitigating evidence, and that he didn't know what background evidence the defense was going to present, but he couldn't comment on what he would think the weight of that evidence would be. That's certainly proper, and where the military judge analyzed that challenge similarly, looking at implied bias, the liberal grant mandate, and analyzing it specifically on the basis of that defense challenge, he did not abuse his discretion. Finally, with respect to Colonel Watson, the defense challenged him based on a perceived bias against defense attorneys. However, the military judge found that there was no actual bias in that Colonel Watson did not seem to have a deeply held belief about defense attorneys, either in general or the specific defense attorney. And he didn't have a personal bias that could not yield to instructions. Colonel Watson is a panel member who indicated that his mind had changed about the death penalty, and he would have to see what evidence was presented to him. He specifically said that he's not convinced that he would vote for death. This is dissimilar from, say, Colonel Thornell, who was objected to in the early part of voir dire, who specifically said that he would lean towards voting for the death penalty under the circumstances presented by the defense. And so looking at the voir dire on balance on, as a whole under Miller and Di Natale, we can see that these three members, if we look at the extensive voir dire, the opportunity that the military judge had to judge their credibility, their demeanor, and also explore their responses, he did not abuse his discretion in denying the defense challenges for cause. Pending any further questions from this court on any of the assignments of error.
Counsel, would you briefly reply to the appellant's historical Fifth Amendment argument?
With respect to the service connection.
With respect to service connection and the whether the charges arose in the land naval forces.
Your Honor, the historical argument that appellant puts forward is very similar to the argument that Solario held to be deeply flawed. And so when we're looking at whether this arises in the land and naval forces, again, this is it's very similar in some ways to the service connection, but there is an interest in the military prosecuting crimes by service members against service members' families, at the very minimum for the preservation of good order and discipline. And as the preamble to the manual for court-martial indicates, that is part of the national defense. The purpose of military justice is to ensure that good order and discipline. And therefore, the government respectfully disagrees with appellant's reading of the Fifth Amendment argument and believes that, that Solario is the appropriate test.
Counsel, I asked about something mentioned in appellant's reply brief, which was that at no stage of the proceedings did the government treat the appellant as a retiree, and that they had not asserted jurisdiction over him as a retiree. Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor, because, again, turning to Hooper and to Pearson, whether the government effectuated the recall in order to facilitate the actual logistics of the court-martial, the jurisdiction over appellant as a retiree at the time that we court-martialed him never changed. The question of the recall for purposes of actually conducting government disagrees that there was any change in status. And it certainly, to the extent that the Army did not lose jurisdiction over appellant when he went from being active duty to retiree, there is it does not stand to reason that it would lose jurisdiction by taking him from a retiree to an active status. That simply doesn't follow.
Did he cease to be a retiree when he was put on an active status?
No, Your Honor. Your Honor, I think that recall from that retired list, that 10 U.S.C. 10141 list to inactive status, makes him an active duty person also subject to Article 2. So regardless of whether we began the court-martial or the proceedings when he was a retiree and then actually facilitated that when he was recalled to active duty by virtue of our AR 2710, there's nothing about personal jurisdiction that changes. We cannot lose personal jurisdiction by bringing him from a retired to an active status for purposes of command and control over his court-martial.
But then is he under A1?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is he under A1 then?
During his court-martial, Your Honor? I would say so, yes.
Are you making the argument at all with respect to his being recalled as a reservist?
Your Honor, the government disagrees that he was recalled as a reservist. As we noted in our brief, there is a fairly Byzantine series of statutes that controls when the retired reserve list, but again, 10 U.S.C. 10141 indicates that people in the quote-unquote retired reserve, that unit that is administered by the reserves, are in a retired status, which would qualify you for Article 2 jurisdiction. So the government disagrees that he was ever a reservist and in the sense of jurisdiction that can only be accomplished once someone is on active duty. So yes, the government disagrees with that and believes he was always a retiree and then brought to active duty to facilitate, as in Hooper, that court-martial, or pardon me, facilitate, as in Pearson, the court-martial.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Does the appellant have rebuttal?
I'd like to address the first, third, and sixth assignments of error. So that is the break in service, the personal jurisdiction, and the denial of a defense. And then I would like to conclude with a thought that wraps up all of these things. When it comes to the break in service, the government relies exclusively on Willingbrink for the proposition that their interpretation is okay. And we've already submitted that Willingbrink is not controlling law in this case, but the broader picture here and the bigger problem with relying on Willingbrink is that it was clearly aimed at ensuring a trial on the merits. That's the problem with a statute of limitations assertion. Here we have the exact opposite. We have a trial, two of them, on the merits. Willingbrink does not reach this case, and if anything, it stands for the exact contrary understanding of Article 3A, the one that is most consistent with the legislative history, Gallagher, and again, the intent and purpose behind this was to ensure that cases that could never be tried have some form of last resort. Not that the United States Army would become a forum for re-prosecution when states decide it serves their best interest. That interpretation is an expansion of jurisdiction, and again, all of the fundamental Supreme Court precedents dealing with the nature of military authority counsel us to restrict, not to expand. Now, again, the government cited Hennisburg as a situation somehow incorporating United States versus Hennis. It is, again, the exact opposite. Hennisburg could not be tried anywhere in the United States. Hennis was tried twice in North Carolina. Chief Judge Stuckey, you asked a question about when is the time? What time matters here? It's the time of the offense. That is the cleanest, most consistent, and most workable understanding. Judge Olson, you presented the absurdity raised in this interpretation to the government, and I have to admit I didn't really hear a good answer why the government can weaponize a protection to use it to haul somebody in for a third trial when the very protection that our founders fought for was designed to prevent successive trials. There is no answer to that.
Major Burroughs, what if in this case, instead of him being acquitted, what if what happened was he'd been tried twice, got a retrial in the state, tried a second time in the state, and was convicted? And for whatever reasons, the Army decided maybe he got a sentence, not the death sentence, but he got a sentence that was not, in its view, consistent with the interest in the maintenance of good order in the Army, and they decided to try him. Would your argument be the same? In other words, he gets basically convicted twice.
The same result would retain because the double jeopardy clause isn't just focused on acquittals and convictions. It is focused on successive trials.
Right, but in that instance, because has there been instances like that where the Army has actually, or another service has actually prosecuted a military offender after he or she has been convicted in a state court? And under Gamble, I think that's now allowed under the separate, well, has always been allowed, under the separate sovereigns doctrine. Right?
Your Honor, that is the holding of Gamble. However, I don't think Gamble reaches the question raised in Barkas, which is whether the federal government and the state governments can collude in prosecutions. And I know that's not an issue that this court granted argument on, but...
Is that what your claim is, that they've colluded to bring this case?
Yes, Your Honor. And our Fourth Assignment of Error details every reason for that.
No, I understand. I understand.
But, yeah, the double jeopardy protection would also prevent, in this case, let's just say hypothetically, Hennis had been convicted and that conviction stood, the military would still not have jurisdiction. The idea here is that what Congress wanted was to ensure in cases such as these there is some forum, and the preference is clearly for civilian forums, not courts-martial. And, again, that is the only approach consistent with Toth, Kinsella, and all of these fundamental cases, urging restraint. Because we have a problem. When we expand military jurisdiction, it comes at the expense of civilian jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court...
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying, because you're saying that there's no authority for the military to try someone who has been convicted in a state court. Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. In this particular case, there was a sham and a cover prosecution, as we discussed.
Well, let's pretend like there was no sham, for instance. Let's assume, for the sake of the argument, there was no collusion, no scam, no sham, none of that. And there simply has been a state conviction. I simply was wondering if your position would be the same. In other words, if the military member is convicted in the state, that the military has no authority under the Double Jeopardy Clause to try this accused for even the same offense in the military.
As those questions bear on the Article 3A argument, the answer would be he still is not subject to revived jurisdiction. Now, as they relate to...
Well, that's the jurisdiction here. I'm talking about you've kind of cast this in the double jeopardy sense in your presentation here right now. And I'm trying to understand if it's a double jeopardy problem, why the Supreme Court hasn't simply already resolved it.
In terms of...
Can I maybe put it a different way?
Go ahead.
Which is, based on your reading of Article 3 Alpha, right, no person that had ever been tried by a state court, whether they were convicted or acquitted, could also be tried by the military justice system.
If Article 3 Alpha, as it applies in this case, applies to this hypothetical, then there would have been a trial in another forum, and the interest in Congress in drafting Article 3A would have been vindicated.
But but your reading of Article 3A then butts up against the dual sovereign doctrine.
That's my problem.
Which says that, in fact, you may be tried by the state, and whether you are acquitted or convicted, you may also be tried by a separate sovereign, whether it be the federal district court or the military federal court, but it's permissible under double jeopardy. But your reading of 3 Alpha would preclude that happening ever.
Precisely. And Congress did so by creating the statute as it is. So there may be, in general, this dual sovereigns authority, and I think in...
Are you suggesting that basically military jurisdiction is of such a nature that you could be tried in U.S. District Court, but you could not be tried by a court-martial, assuming, Article II jurisdiction? assuming you're an active duty member of the armed forces, you seem to be saying that the way Article 3 is written, that military jurisdiction is disfavored. I mean, you've said that. But under the separate sovereign doctrine, you could be tried in U.S. District Court and by the state.
So presuming that there were, there was a statutory basis for doing so, well, then, yes, the double jeopardy clause in that context wouldn't be implicated. But here, again, in 1951, Congress enacted this version of the code. So I'm not talking about our current Article 3A, which isn't relevant to this case. I'm talking about the one that governs Hennessy's. Congress viewed military jurisdiction in this case, where someone has left the service, there is a break, a definitive hold over that. They didn't want to use courts-martial as a tool for expanding jurisdiction. Again,
given Article 2 as it was enacted in 50, that's a dubious assertion. The court had to go in with Reed and Covert and Kinsella and all those other things to get what it wanted. So I'm not at all sure that Congress didn't want to expand jurisdiction. Whether they succeeded or not is another matter. But
can you briefly conclude?
Yes, sir. With the 13 seconds remaining, I really just want to emphasize one quote from Tothby Quarles, which is that free countries of the world have tried to restrict military tribunals to the narrowest jurisdiction deemed absolutely essential for maintaining discipline among troops in active service. And when we look at what we have here, we have a court-martial seeking to impose the death penalty on an individual who had left active service, retired, who had been acquitted for the very same offenses in a state court. This is anything but narrow and absolutely essential, and this court should dismiss this case.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until 0900.